I wonder suddenly if this house has been abandoned since the war. If so, I'm looking through a window, but seeing back in time almost 80 years. I have no idea how or why Bobcha came to leave this place, but it's unexpectedly eerie to think that I might be staring all the way back into that point of her life. Maybe she was sitting at that table when the moment came when her life changed forever, and maybe that journey she began that day ended all the way in America and with our family. Just as I step away from the window, my mom calls. Hi, I smile down the camera lens. Alice, hello, Mom says. I have one very excited grandmother here. She turns the phone to Bobcha, who has tears pouring down her face and is grinning at me like I've just discovered the Holy Grail. Yen dobra, Bobcha, I say, and she gives me a delighted smile and an awkward clap. I flip the camera and walk all around the house, showing her the fields, the decrepit barn, and even the long overgrown yard around the house. As I walk around, I shift my gaze from the fall of my steps to her reaction on the screen. I watch the dawning joy and sadness and longing on her face, and I know we're at the right place. I can't help but imagine the scene playing out in a very different way if we'd made this trip together 10 years ago. I'd have asked her a million or more questions. Maybe she'd have answered some. Alice, Mom interrupts me after a few minutes, and then it's her face filling the screen again. I need to get to Chambers. Is that it then? She seems... Mom's eyes flick from the camera, then back to me. She shrugs and smiles, and her sudden approval is quite dazzling. You know, she suddenly seems incredibly happy. Good, I say, and I beam at her. Good. I pause, thinking again about that missing birth record, then ask, Mom, did she ever tell you she was born in the house she grew up in? That's right. She and her twin brothers and her sister were all born at home. I glance at Zofia. She's tilted her head to the side, and she's staring at the iPad curiously. Huh, Zofia murmurs thoughtfully. She raises her voice a little as she confirms. Twin brothers, you say? Hello there, Mom says, frowning. Who is that, Alice? I adjust the camera so that Mom can see Zofia, and Zofia waves and smiles. Mom, meet Zofia. Zofia, meet my mom, Judge Julita Slosky Davis. It is so lovely to meet you, Julita, Zofia says. Tell me, was Hannah the youngest of her family? That's correct. She used to tell me she was the spoiled baby girl, although I don't imagine spoiled in her childhood context means the same as it does in ours. Do you know her siblings' names? Mom looks uncharacteristically uncertain. I always thought the sister's name was Amelia, but then we saw the list she wrote for Alice last week, and it said Emilia, so I'm not really sure. Emilia was Pa's little sister, I confirm for Mom, and she sighs. I'm really not at all sure how it all fits together. I distinctly remember her saying she was writing to her sister, but maybe I'm wrong. Perhaps her parents' names? Zofia prompts. Do you know what they were? I only remember her mother's name. That was definitely Faustina. Mom gives a little laugh. The Catholic Church canonized a Saint Faustina, goodness, maybe 20 years ago, and Bobcha was excited like a kid in a candy store. Ah, her mother was Faustina, and her father was... Zofia reaches into her handbag and withdraws her iPad, then says, Bartok, yes? I see Mom glance beside herself, and I can hear some kind of movement off screen. Mom is frowning. What is it, Mom? Is everything okay? Hang on a minute, Alice, Mom says, and the camera shows her walking back to the bed. She sets the phone down for a moment onto the bedside table, I think, and all I can see is the ceiling in the hospital room. Mama, are you okay? The camera swings wildly, and for a moment the camera is blocked by a finger. It shifts, and then I see Bobcha's face. Hello, Bobcha, I murmur by habit. She looks distressed and frustrated, and I peer helplessly into the screen. Mom, could you give her the iPad? I think she wants to tell us something. Alice, did you say she still understands spoken Polish? Zofia asks me softly. I nod and she extends her hand toward my phone. Do you mind if I... May I? I pass her the phone and Zofia smiles gently into the camera. She speaks very slowly and carefully for a few minutes in Polish. A single tear rolls down Bobcha's cheek, but she's nodding. Zofia looks at me and she grins. Well, that's one mystery solved. It is? Alina Dziak was the youngest child of Faustina and Bartók Dziak. They had four children, a daughter, Truda, twin sons, and then Alina. I only remembered the composition of the family because the twins and Alina were born very close together, and I felt so sorry for poor Faustina, Zofia says wryly, but then she sobers. Alice, I just asked your grandmother if she is Alina, and she's nodding yes. My eyes widen. What? Mom, are you listening to this? I see Mom hand Babcia the iPad, and she takes her phone back. Her face fills the screen, and she's frowning. Her name is Hannah, Mom says stiffly. She's confused. I couldn't find any records at all for Hannah, or a family of origin with that surname in this district, Zofia tells Mom gently. It makes no sense. If this is her childhood home, and she and her siblings were born here, the Vishnevsky family would have left behind some records. Mom is shaking her head, but then I hear the electronic sound of a camera shutter in the background at the hospital room. Mom looks away from the screen, and then I hear Babcia's iPad say, Alina. And Mom's eyes widen in disbelief. She silently turns the camera around, and I see Babcia sitting on the bed, the iPad resting awkwardly on her lap, facing toward Mom. Babcia's face is set in a mask of pure determination, and she's made a label on the iPad screen for Alina, complete with a brand new selfie of herself for the image. After a moment or two, Babcia gives us an impatient look. Then she holds her left forefinger up, points to the screen, then stabs her finger against her own chest. Holy shit, I say. That's pretty definitive confirmation, Zofia says. No, I don't believe this, Mom says. She turns the camera around again and she's scowling at the screen. Alice, I don't understand this. It makes no sense at all. She's lied to me for my whole life? No, I don't. Mom, I interrupt her carefully. Remember she wanted you to name me Alina? Maybe it does make at least a little sense. Mom's expression stiffens. We stare at each other for a moment, then the camera picks up the sound of Babcia's iPad speaking again. Alina, fire, Thomas. Babcia, fire, Thomas. Alina, fire, Thomas. Christ, she's getting upset now, Mom mutters. She's visibly frustrated, and she glares into the camera screen. I'm going to go calm her down. Alice, I'll talk to you later. I need to think about this. The call disconnects abruptly, and I sigh and glance at Zofia. So, my grandmother adopted a false identity 80-odd years ago. Is that what we're assuming here? I think that's fair to deduce, yes. Any ideas why? There are an infinite number of possible explanations. Identity forgery was a thriving industry in occupied Poland. Zofia shrugs. Perhaps she ran afoul of the Nazis at some point and needed to go into hiding. There's not really any way for us to know, unless she finds a way to tell us. I look around the farm again. There's not really that much here, but I find I'm not at all ready to leave, so I make an excuse to stay. I think I'll take some more photos. I'd like to send some back to my husband and my kids. Take as much time as you like, Alice. Zofia smiles, and then she steps away from me and says, I'll give you some space, hey? I'll wait for you at the car. When I've photographed every feature I can find around Babcia's old house, Zofia and I drive back into the town. The next address is only about a mile away from the farmhouse, nestled deep within a narrow laneway. As Zofia turns the car into the little street, I survey the towering trees along the sidewalk. Sweet chestnut trees, Zofia explains. They are all through that huge park at the end of the street, too. What a beautiful spot. I'm guessing this must have been quite a prestigious address in your grandmother's time. There are some very old, very large houses here, and when we first enter the street, I fully expect that we're headed toward one of them. I'm disappointed, though, because the number my grandmother has guided us toward happens to be one of the recently modernized homes in the street. I guess we got lucky with the farmhouse, but whatever she was expecting to find here seems to be long gone, Zofia says. There doesn't seem much I can do except take some photos to show her what it looks like now, I say with a sigh. We knock on the door anyway and discover that the owners now are a young professional couple, and the house has sold at least twice in the last 20 years, so the woman who answers the door has no idea why my grandmother might have wanted a photo of it. Still, she's warm and friendly, and once we explain why we're there, she's kind enough to offer to show us through the house in case it's of importance. As we enter the ultra-modern lobby, It's clear that whatever Bobcia wanted us to find here is long gone. We leave empty-handed, and I knew this might happen, but it's disappointing after the high of seeing the farmhouse and discovering Bobcia's real name. It's now well past lunchtime, and my stomach is starting to growl. Zofia suggests we take a break, so we head back to the town square for a break. Let's see what this afternoon brings, she winks, as we sit down to lunch. After we eat, I leave Zofia to the second coffee she desperately needs, and I walk to a nearby laneway to find some privacy to call back to my family. Where are you, Mommy? Callie asks as soon as I call. The connection is not great here, so the video feed of her face isn't quite as clear as it was yesterday in the city. But even so, the sight of her is enough to make me feel a pang of homesickness for the first time. I push that away and keep my tone light. We're at a small town called Trebinia, which is where Bobcia and Pa were born, I tell her. How's things back there? Oh, you know, she says. Don't worry, I'm helping Dad more now. He's almost got the basics down pat. Almost. I try to laugh, but it comes out with a wince, and Callie's expression grows a little sadder. Mommy, when Daddy goes away for work, we miss him a lot, but this is so different. I just really miss you. I miss you too, honey bear, I say sadly. Callie's big eyes fill with tears, and she blinks rapidly. Anyway, she says, and for just a second, she sounds so much older than her 10 years that my heart aches a little more. She exhales, then asks me brightly, Have you found anything else cool today? I fill her in about the farmhouse, and then promise to send her some photos. When Wade takes the phone, the homesickness returns. I spend a lot of time at home worrying about the things that seem broken in my marriage. It's only now, when I'm on the other side of the world, that it's crystal clear to me that some things are still whole. The connection between us feels less vibrant than it once was, but Wade is still my best friend, and I'm still deeply, hopelessly drawn to him. Hey, I say softly.
Hello, lovely wife, he says with a smile. How's things in glamorous Europe?
Oh, glamorous, I joke, turning the camera around to show him a view of the laneway. When I switch the camera back, he's laughing. We visited Bobcha's childhood home, and we called back to Mom while we were there so Bobcha got to see it. That was pretty amazing, actually. Such a special moment. I'm so glad I got to do that for her. And guess what? Bobcha's real name is Alina.
No way.
It's true. Mom told me the other day that she'd tried to convince Mom to give me that name, but we had no idea where it came from, I say.
That's incredible. Any idea why she used another name once she moved here?
We don't know yet. Oh, and Zofia is lovely, by the way, an excellent driver and very knowledgeable. Well done.
Thank you.
Wade does a fake bow for the camera, and then we both pause. Things seem more peaceful at home today, but I'm nervous to ask how Eddie is.
He's in his room, watching his videos, Wade says, correctly hearing the question I haven't asked, which thrills me. He's doing okay, Alice. I took him into the office yesterday, and he made friends with some of my team.
My eyes widen at that. Really?
Sure, Wade says, and he shrugs. Well, when you think about it, my office is kind of Eddie's ideal place. I mean, there are rules upon rules upon rules, and everything is written down. I just gave him the visitor safety manual, he read through it, and then he sat quietly in my office all day and played with his iPad. Oh, then he came with me to a meeting, and he just sat and played with that dreidel thing for a while. It probably helps that none of my lab rats are particularly chatty. Eddie was right at home in a way.
Wade pauses, then clears his throat and admits with obvious difficulty.
Made me wonder why I haven't done it before.
I feel a sudden rush of confusion because I'm somehow delighted and relieved at this admission, but I'm also instantly resentful. In these last few years, I've given up trying to convince Wade to try to connect with Eddie, but before that, in the early years, back then, I tried all the damned time. Be the bigger person, Alice. Don't say it. Do not say it. I told you years ago you should take him to the office with you one day. I told you he'd love it. I told you that your team would understand, but you said it would be too dangerous, but I told you, I blurt. Wade's jaw tightens.
I know you did, he says stiffly.
I have to redirect this conversation before it spirals into an argument, but I need some more information about my son, so I try to brighten my tone as I ask, And did he sleep last night? Has he eaten?
Wade is staring at the camera a little warily now.
I gave him the melatonin last night, and yes, he slept pretty well. He's been asking for you on the iPad sometimes. Pascal has been pointing him back to that calendar you made him.
His gaze softens, and so does his tone, as he provides me with reassurance I desperately need.
It's nothing we can't handle, though, honey. Everything is okay.
All I can think about for a second is my poor son, bewildered by my absence, asking again and again, but with no way to really understand why I disappeared while he was at school one day. Just as the tension starts winding through my body, I force myself to think about how bad this all could have been, how bad I expected it to be, and the positive things that have already come out of this trip. If Wade can just take Eddie to work with him on the very rare occasion when I'm sick or I can't juggle Eddie and Callie's schedules, my whole life would change. I'd have a backup plan for the moments when I so desperately need one. I'd have a chance of some respite every now and again. I'd have someone to pick up the slack when I need a break, someone to share the ups and downs with, which is all I ever wanted in the first place. I open my mouth to say something like this, but at the very last second, a stack of out-of-place objects in the background of the video feed catches my eye. Wade, what's that on the countertop? Wade glances behind himself, then he shrugs.
Cans of soup.
Why? Wade, why are there 6 cans of Eddie's soup on the bench?
I don't know, Alice. I didn't notice them until now. I guess Eddie is putting them there.
He clears his throat, then adds with audible bewilderment.
For some reason.
There's only one reason Eddie puts soup on the bench. He does it when he's hungry and I'm running late or busy with something, so he wants to hurry me up. If there are 6 cans of soup there, that probably meant he asked for dinner and didn't get it, so he tried to hurry things along by getting a can out. And when that didn't work, he tried it again and again. What did he eat for dinner the last 2 nights, Wade? I demand. My tone has sharpened again. That gratitude I was feeling a moment ago is gone. I'm shifting into full tiger mother mode, and Wade knows it. Even over the slightly pixelated video feed, I can see the defensiveness in his gaze.
I gave him some McDonald's the first night like Pascal and I had, and last night we had mac and cheese.
How much yogurt did he eat yesterday?
It's fine, Alice, Wade snaps. He's eating. I'm handling it. An attempt at variety can only be good for him. How healthy do you think it is for him to eat only 2 foods for his entire diet?
How healthy do you think McDonald's and mac and cheese are? I exclaim incredulously. Just make him the damn soup. I knew you'd do this, Wade. He doesn't eat anything that's solid or has lumps in it. He has sensory-
Listen, I'll give him the soup.
Wade's tone takes on an urgent, conciliatory tone, as he apparently realizes that the tension that's been simmering underneath much of this conversation is about to boil over. Even the tone of his voice frustrates me now, because he's not conceding that I'm right. He just doesn't want to get into a screaming match with me when I'm 5,000 miles away.
I just didn't notice that he was putting it there, okay? I just thought it would do him some good to try different foods, to get used to different textures so his diet wasn't so restrictive. He's not starving anyway, not in 2 days, and he's been eating loads of yogurt. I even got him eating the Go-Gurt with the new label.
You can't just change his entire routine, Wade, I interrupt him impatiently. I've worked his entire life to get him to this point.
Alice, Wade says. His voice is deadly quiet now. I'm trying here, okay? We agreed that you'd go on this trip and I'd handle things at home. We even agreed I'd do this my way. I made a mistake with the soup. I'll fix it today.
The rapid de-escalation is every bit as frustrating as the rapid escalation was. Because I really want to make him understand how important it is that Eddie gets that soup. But just then, I notice Zofia walking around the corner. She's looking at her own phone and doesn't seem to be paying attention to me, but she surely heard at least part of that conversation, and I'm embarrassed. I puff out my cheeks as I exhale, then look away from the phone for a minute as my eyes fill with tears. I better go, I say abruptly.
You don't want to talk to Eddie?
Wade frowns. I shake my head and a tear spills over. I'm too upset to talk to Eddie, and I know Eddie would see through any facade I tried to put up. There's no point upsetting the poor kid more. No, Zofia is back and we have things to do. Maybe I can call tonight.
Have a good day, Alice,
he says, but his jaw is still set tight. You too, Wade, I echo. I missed him when he answered, but by the time I hang up the phone,
I feel only relief to be saying goodbye. I'm impossibly frustrated, and it takes me quite a few minutes to realize that I cut my husband off as he tried to tell me something about the new label on the Go-Gurt. And now that I really think about it, it sounded like he said something about Eddie eating from the tubes with the new labels, something I was 100% sure would never be possible.
Chapter 31. Alina. Tomas and I were packing food into pails to take across to Saul and Ava when he suddenly stopped and looked at me. Maybe Saul and Ava could come here instead of us taking the food to them. That way they could have it all.
Will Jan let us get them out? I asked uncertainly.
Tomas grimaced and shook his head. No, he'd be furious if we woke him.
Well, they won't fit through the latch.
Tikva will be easy, and maybe we can very quietly pull away just a few more of the boards on the wall around the latch. We wouldn't need much more space to be able to pull Saul and Ava through, too. Jan wouldn't be happy, but if we're careful enough not to wake him, he won't find it until morning, and we'll all be long gone by the time he even knows. I know it's only a short-term fix, but it would be so much more comfortable for them here, even if it's just for a few nights. He paused, then he nodded, apparently having made up his mind. Alina, I think I can make this work.
My parents won't mind, I said unthinkingly.
Tomas looked at me sadly, and I cleared my throat.
I mean, if they manage to come home.
We decided to at least try. We still had some time to spare, and so we left to make that fraught trek through the fields to the back of the house next door. When we were close, Tomas pressed his fingers to his lips, just as he'd done the previous night. He bent to check for the rock. Then Tomas stood, frowning. He gave me a hand signal to wait here, and then he inched around the corner and along the wall toward the front of the house. I remained at the back corner, but I stretched my head out from the corner so I could watch him. When he reached the front corner of the house, his shoulders slumped. As he turned around that next corner, I caught a glimpse of his face in the moonlight, and the pain in his expression was so vivid that it took my breath away. Tomas was no longer trying to hide. Instead, he stepped away from the wall, his hand outstretched as if he was reaching for someone. I knew he told me to wait where I was, but I couldn't, not having seen the expression on his face. I repeated that same journey he had just made, with careful footsteps along the wall of the house.
No, Tomas.
The hoarse words were carried on the otherwise silent night air.
You can't be here. They asked about you. What if they came back for you? If you think I am leaving you alone to deal with this, Tomas choked in return. You are sadly mistaken, my brother.
I wanted to stay at the back of the house, but my legs seemed to have other ideas. They propelled me forward automatically after Tomas, and when I reached the front corner of the house, I took a deep breath and forced myself to peer around it. I couldn't even make sense of the scene before me at first. Under the glow of the moonlight, Saul sat slumped on the front step, Ava's limp body cradled across his lap. I gasped as I recognized the unseeing face of baby Tikva, her tiny body tucked tightly between her parents' torsos. Saul's face was set in a mask of grief too deep to be understood, his jaw slack, his eyes wide. And now that I was closer, I could see that the only movement he made was the sporadic blink of his swollen eyelids and the rattling inhale, then exhale of his chest.
Saul, Tomas whispered, what happened?
Saul turned toward Tomas's voice, but his gaze was unfocused. He blinked again and then gave a shake of his head. Then a convulsion racked his whole body, and he pulled Ava and the baby higher against his neck as a series of sobs broke over him. I stayed at the corner of the front of the house, unable to look away, but far too afraid to move closer. Tomas, however, sat right beside his friend and slid his arm over his shoulders.
Saul,
Tomas said again, and this time his own voice broke.
I'm so sorry, my friend. I'm just so sorry. The soldiers knew everything. They even knew about you and Nadia.
Saul sobbed, and I caught the full force of agony in his expression as he turned to face Tomas.
Tomas, they have taken everything from me now. There is nothing left for me to live for. Run for your life, but let me die. Please let me die.
Tomas sat on the step with Saul for so long that my legs became numb, and I had to sink down to sit on the ground. Although I stayed at the corner of the house, I couldn't bring myself to go near them. Partly out of respect for Saul's right to privacy as he grieved, and partly because I was sickened by the sight of the bodies and the heavy scent of blood in the air. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw baby Tikva's face in my mind. She had been sleeping when I held her, but now that I had seen her face set in death, I could no longer remember the innocence of that moment when she was safe within my arms. And the worst thing was that I knew, from having witnessed Alexei's and the mayor's deaths, that this image was a part of me now. I would never be the same again, having witnessed this moment in time. After a while, Tomas stood and he approached me. His face and his beard were wet with tears, and as he embraced me, he was shaking.
Alina, he whispered, I have to ask something of you. Can you wait with him?
Wait with him? I whispered back, my gaze frantically flicking to the man and the bodies just a few feet away.
Where are you going?
He is covered in their blood, Tomas whispered. He needs fresh clothes. I will have to go back to your house and get something for him to wear.
Can't we all go? Can't we take him with us?
We have to.
Tomas broke off. His gaze dropped, then returned to mine.
We have to bury them first, my love. It is the very least they deserve.
I squeezed my eyes closed for a minute, then suggested hopefully, but Jan's clothes will be inside.
Jan is entirely responsible for the death of Saul's wife and baby Alina. I can't ask that of him.
I wanted to say no, and the old Alina would have. But I was determined to be an adult now, and to make Tomas proud of the woman I'd become. Still, it wasn't easy to agree to remain alone with a man and two horrific bodies in a space where Nazis had clearly been in recent hours, particularly given the likelihood that they'd return. I gritted my teeth as I said, "Can we at least move him into shelter?"
The inside of the house, it is.
Tomas trailed off, then shook his head.
Don't go in there, love. I saw it through the door. It's a mess.
He brushed my hair back from my face, and he whispered,
I really don't think they will come back here tonight. He still can't tell me what happened, but either they purposefully left him alive, or he somehow hid from them. And if they do come back, it will be in a vehicle, so you'll see the lights or hear the engine long before they near the house. Take him to the barn and hide, okay?
My breath caught, and I bit my lip hard and forced myself to nod. My chest felt tight, as if the fear could choke the life right out of me, too. Tomas nodded towards Saul, encouraging me to go to the other man's side, and I whimpered a little as I made myself step closer to the bodies. I told myself not to look at the baby again. I told myself I could sit with him and pretend it wasn't there. But I couldn't look away, and it was Tikva I stared at as I walked. As I came closer, the stench of blood became overwhelming, and my stomach turned over again and again. I battled to clamp down the urge to retch, but I walked to Saul's side, and I sat right beside him as Tomas had done.
"Hello, Saul. It's Alina," I said, very gently. "Tomas is going to get you fresh clothes. I'm going to stay with you. You are not alone. We are here for you."
The man turned to me, and I could see him trying to focus his gaze.
"Thank you for your kindness, Alina," he choked out.
I nodded once, and as I went to look away again, he blurted,
"I don't know if they caught Jan or if he turned us in, but he must have told them everything. Everything. Where we were hiding, how we were surviving. They wanted us to give Tomas up. They told Eva they'd let her go if she told them where to find him. But she was far too smart for that, my beautiful, brilliant wife. But then, they took Tikva from Eva's arms."
"You don't have to tell me," I whispered hastily, but he didn't seem to hear me.
"And they put her on the ground. And they shot her in the chest because they thought then we'd talk. But didn't they realize? Once they shot her, we had nothing left to survive for anyway. And then, my wife."
It occurred to me then that he wasn't speaking for my benefit at all. This was a repeat of those moments with Emilia each Sunday, on my own front steps. Just like little Emilia, Saul just needed to tell someone what had happened to his family. And I happened to be the only bystander now that he was ready to talk.
"Eva was hysterical, and the soldier who was holding her, he threw her against the wall, and she went quiet, and I could see her skull was... I tried, but it was... no. So I was hoping I'd be next, and we could travel together to the afterlife. But I didn't flinch or try to fight to get away once the others were gone. The sergeant was so angry that I didn't struggle. He said to leave me. He said it was a worse punishment to let me alone to die slowly."
Saul's voice broke again.
"I begged them to shoot me. I want to be with my family."
I didn't know what to say to that, and all I could think was to do as Tomas had done, and to slide my arm over Saul's thin shoulders. He slumped forward again, utterly broken, as he whispered,
"How God must hate me to leave me to suffer like this. Surely..."
"Don't you say that," I said fiercely, and Saul startled, as if he'd only just noticed I was there. I was sorry to speak so harshly to him, but I knew all too well that the only way we'd survive the darkness was to hold on to a vestige of hope. There was nothing else I could do for Saul, except to keep my arm on his shoulder and point him back to what he still had. And all that he had was his faith.
"You must believe that if God allowed you to survive this far, there is a purpose to it. You must believe that there is work left for you to do on this earth before you are released to peace. Hold tight to what you have left, Saul Weiss. And if all you have left is your faith, then you cling to it with every shred of strength you have left. Do you hear me?"
He blinked at me. For a minute, I thought I'd gone too far, and I was shaken by an intense regret. Who was I to speak so harshly to this Jewish man about his faith in the very moment when he nursed the cooling bodies of his entire family? Saul's shuddering breaths were coming harder and faster, but then he nodded sharply and he turned his head toward the fields and he closed his eyes. The string of words that burst from his lips was a language I didn't know, but our traditions were irrelevant in that moment. The depth of his loss transcended every one of our differences. We weren't Jew and Catholic. We weren't even man and woman. We were simply two human beings, grieving an inhuman act. I squeezed my eyes tightly closed so I didn't accidentally look down at the face of the baby beside me, and I bowed my head while Saul and I prayed together. Tomas was very quiet when he returned, carrying two full pails of supplies and with a set of clothing for Saul over his shoulders. He emptied the supplies onto the ground, then filled the pails at the well nearby. While I sat some distance away to give them privacy, my wonderful Tomas helped Saul to clean the bodies. And finally, he helped Saul to bathe and dress himself. Saul insisted on digging the grave, but he was just too weak, and eventually he had to accept help. He would labor with visible difficulty until he had to stop, then Tomas would work furiously until Saul had rested and was ready to take another turn. There wasn't time for depth or care. Instead, they were seeking only to give Eva and baby Tikva the dignity of a resting place. Saul carried his wife into the grave first. He was almost calm in that moment as he carefully set her down and spoke to her gently. Then he kissed her forehead. The calmness disappeared when Tomas handed him the body of his infant daughter. Saul began to wail again, loudly and inconsolably. He bent to place the baby on Ava's chest, then he carefully wrapped her arms around their daughter. At the very last minute, Saul bent again and took one of the tiny leather shoes from Tikva's feet. As I watched that man climb reluctantly away from the family he was leaving in the earth, I knew how desperately he wished to be staying with them. After Tomas filled the grave, Saul dropped to his knees beside it, and he prayed aloud around shuddering sobs, clutching that tiny shoe against his chest. Tomas wiped his eyes and jogged to my side. We embraced, and he whispered thickly, "We're running out of time." "I know," I whispered back. "But we can't leave him here. Is there anyone else we can take him to?" Tomas stepped away from me, and he stared at me then. "No," I said automatically. "No, Tomas, we can't stay here. You said it yourself. If we stay..." "I have no intention of us staying," he interrupted me. "It's not safe for you. They know your name. They know what you look like. You cannot stay, Alina. There is no chance I am going to sit by and watch while..." "They know who you are too now," I exclaimed. "Did you not hear what Saul said? This is exactly why we have to leave." "They know who I am, which means it's only a matter of time before they figure out who Emilia is," Tomas said abruptly. I hadn't thought of that, and as he said it, my stomach dropped. "I have to tell my other friends to flee. I have to warn your sister and get Emilia to safety. But..." He grabbed my upper arms in his palms, and he held me tightly, his gaze hard on mine as he whispered, "Alina, you must go. We can't miss this chance."
"What? No, I can't go alone, Tomas," I cried in shock,
and his beautiful green eyes pleaded with me as his voice broke on a sob.
"I know. I know that is too much to ask, and yet I am asking even more of you than that."
I stared at him blankly, and then his gaze tracked back to Saul, still sobbing on his knees by the grave.
"Tomas."
"He is weak. He is in shock. You're going to have to carry him, if not physically, then emotionally. But you'll see, once he's well, he is qualified, a fully equipped specialist with immense knowledge and skill. He can do so much good.
He can help hundreds, maybe thousands of people. It would be unforgivable for me to go tonight when he could go in my place.
No, don't ask this of me. I can't.
Please, Moya Fistko.
I can't go without you.
I'm begging you, Alina, Tomas said. He was still staring down at me with that same intense expression, but I heard the shift in his tone. He had made up his mind, and nothing I said was going to change it.
How would this even work? Does he even have identity papers? Won't they be Jewish identity papers? Will they even admit him to the camp?
We can't risk it, Tomas murmured. He released me gently, and I opened my eyes to see him reach into the pocket of his trousers. He carefully withdrew a card, which he opened to show me. Illuminated only by the moonlight, I saw his tattered passport. There was a tiny photo of him on the page, but the image was worn and so dark, even I might never have recognized him. It is from before I even left for college, back when Father used to take me on vacations. Surely the camp will never know the difference. This photo looks nothing like either of us now that we both have beards. And his hair is darker, but the photo is so dark. I am sure he can pass. I am sure of it.
I don't want to do this, I choked.
It's not forever, Tomas said. Then he stopped to draw in a desperate breath. As soon as my other friends are safe, as soon as Emilia and your sister are safe, I will find a way to come after you. Henry will arrange to get me false papers, and we will meet up in Buzuluk. By then we were both sobbing, clutching at each other, each one of us desperate to change the other's mind.
I am not strong enough to do this. I am not brave enough. I am not clever.
You are all of those things, Alina Dziak. And more, Tomas said fiercely. You are the fire that keeps my heart beating, and the fuel that has powered my dreams even through this war. You are my everything. I know you better than anyone else, and that's the very reason I am trusting you and pleading with you to lead this man to safety tonight. I couldn't say no to him. I wanted desperately to refuse, to plead weakness, to plant my feet in the soil of my homeland and to cling tightly to Tomas, even if it meant death. But I couldn't let him down. I couldn't disappoint him. And even at the time, I understood that this was something Tomas needed to do. Before we could start our life afresh, he simply had to absolve himself of the guilt of his compliance with the Wehrmacht in Warsaw. Given the depth of his loss and the impossible circumstances Saul now faced, Tomas would never be able to resist the opportunity to offer safe passage from hell to the man who had once done the same for him.
Please, Moya Fistko, Tomas whispered. Please.
I caught his head in my hands and I kissed him then, and that kiss said everything there wasn't time to say.
We will always find our way back to each other, Alina,
he breathed when we broke apart.
Our love is bigger than this war. I promise you that.
Chapter 32. Alice. Babcia's next address leads us to a medical clinic, situated in a huge historic building at the corner of two quiet streets. The building has been lovingly and lavishly restored. There's a wheelchair ramp built at the front door and an automatic sliding glass door. Zofia tells me the large sign above the door simply says, Trebinya Medical Clinic, and none of the physicians' names listed on the sign end with Slosky. That would have been a bit too easy, Zofia laughs. But my eyes have fallen to a bronze plaque beside the front door, because although it's in Polish, one word does indeed say Slosky. Actually, I say wryly, and I point to the plaque. Zofia's eyes widen, Then she reads quietly, "In memory of Dr. Alexei Slasky, an example to all of leadership and courage, 1939. Zofia offers me a sad smile. Perhaps we are on the right track after all. I take some photos of the plaque and the building, then I follow Zofia inside the door and survey the interior. It's mid-afternoon, and there are only two people sitting in the patient chairs. But behind the reception desk, a young woman and man are seated. The young man is talking on the phone, but the woman sets her headset down as we enter the room, and she stares at me with an intensity that makes me quite uncomfortable. I wonder what it is about my appearance that gives away that I'm the outsider, not Zofia. As we approach the desk, Zofia greets the receptionists in Polish, then gestures to me and introduces me, but she flicks back to English as she says, "Alice is here from the United States researching her family history. We believe Alexei Slasky may have been her great-grandfather." "Actually, that's not possible," the young woman interrupts Zofia, and she gives us a polite but apologetic smile. "Why do you say that?" Zofia frowns. "Well, Alexei Slasky was my great-grandfather, and my grandmother was his only child." At first, I'm not sure whether I should be disappointed or confused, but I quickly settle on confused, and so I decide to clarify. "Was your grandmother Emilia?" The woman's eyes widen, then she concedes carefully. "Yes, she is." "Well," I say, my heart starts racing as I realize we've stumbled upon a link to someone who's actually on Bobcha's list, and the receptionist said is, not was, so Emilia is alive. "That's fantastic. I was really hoping we could track her down." "Perhaps we should have a chat in private," the woman murmurs. She rises and motions toward a hallway. "Please follow me." She closes the door behind us as we step into a small meeting room. The woman is still offering that same polite smile, but she's crossed her arms over her chest and her gaze has narrowed just a little. "What exactly is it you want from Emilia?" she asks me directly. "Is it money?" "Oh, no," I say, shaking my head. "I don't want anything from her, just to connect with her. Thomas Slasky was her brother, and he was my grandfather." Now the hint of suspicion in the woman's gaze becomes more pronounced. "I'm really sorry, that's not possible." I give her a confused smile and start to counter with, "It's definitely, I don't know where you are getting your information from, but Thomas Slasky died in 1942, she interrupts me gently. I share a confused glance with Zofia. "I'm quite certain about this. I visit his grave with my grandmother sometimes." But memories rise to the forefront of my mind. I think about my grandfather's gentle hugs and the way his rare bursts of laughter could light up a room. He was more alive than just about anyone I know, purely because of the way he threw his arms around life, as if he was constantly searching for an opportunity to make a difference or to give love. But this young woman doesn't know that, and she's looking at me with overt sympathy now. "Thomas is not an uncommon name in Poland, nor is Slasky. I think you have the wrong family." "But your great-grandmother was Julita, yes?" Zofia prompts. "Yes, but I'm not sure what the confusion is, but I know we have our facts straight," Zofia says. "I did the family history research myself. Alexei and Julita Slasky were definitely the parents of Thomas Slasky, born in 1920. And he is Alice's grandfather." "Well, I'm sorry," the woman says, and she's just a little defensive now. "But I'm not mistaken either. Not about this." I'm getting a little desperate here, so I try a different tack. "What's your name?"
"I am Leah Trukin."
"It's really nice to meet you, Leah," I say quietly, hoping to get the conversation back onto a warm footing and disperse this odd tension that's starting to rise. "The thing is, my grandmother is 95 now, and she's quite unwell. She left Poland during the war and wasn't ever able to return. My mother thinks that my grandmother used to send letters to Emilia, maybe even hundreds of letters over the years, trying to get back in touch once the war was ended. We're not sure exactly what she wanted, but it seemed to be very important to her." "Emilia is also very old, and she is also quite unwell," Leah says quietly. "I'm sure you understand why I don't want to upset her. If she didn't reply to your grandmother's letters, there must be a reason." Leah is trying very hard not to be rude, If anything, her gaze is pleading with me for understanding. And I do understand her wanting to protect her grandmother, probably better than most, but that doesn't mean I can let this go. Perhaps they could just talk on the phone. Emilia is very frail, Leah says, a little firmer now. Maybe, I feel this moment slipping away from me, so I fumble to get Leah back on my side. I don't want to upset your grandmother either. That would be terrible. But perhaps if you could tell her about my grandmother, perhaps she might be interested. Who is your grandmother? My grandmother is Hannah Slosky, I say automatically. But Zofia says at the same time, she was Alina Diak before her marriage. Alina or Hannah? Leah looks at us, her suspicion no longer hidden at all. It's complicated, I sigh. Then I briefly explain the morning's events. But the point is, Emilia might know her as Hannah or Alina, but she's definitely Schlosky, the surname we're sure of because she took it when she married my pa. Well, she'd be Alina Schlauska if she'd married a Polish man, Leah points out. I look at Zofia in confusion, and she nods. Well, yes, it is Polish convention to change some suffixes to denote gender. A female would generally be Schlauska rather than Schlosky. But I see this all the time with American clients. The convention generally does not persist after immigration.
It doesn't matter anyway. I don't know her by either name. I'm sure my grandmother has never mentioned her.
Leah sighs.
I still think you've got the wrong family, or perhaps the wrong town.
No, my grandmother definitely said Trebinya, and we even found her childhood home. Besides, all of the other details line up, I say. I look to Zofia, then double-check. Am I missing something here? Everything lines up, Zofia says, frowning at Leah now. Alice and I are quite sure of our facts. Are you sure the disconnect isn't at your end?
Surely you can see how upsetting it would be for me to go to my 85-year-old grandmother and tell her that some American woman thinks her beloved big brother was alive for 75 years longer than he actually was.
Leah isn't quite rude, and she doesn't throw us out of the building. Not exactly. Regardless, Zofia and I quickly find ourselves back outside in the sunshine.
The family must be wealthy, Zofia says.
But we told her we didn't want money, I say helplessly. She shrugs.
If you're Thomas's granddaughter, perhaps he was entitled to a share of whatever inheritance Alexei left behind, and if that was significant, maybe she's nervous about what that would mean for her family.
Zofia glances back at the building. It wouldn't surprise me if she made up the story about the gravesite, just because it gives her an excuse to refuse to engage with us.
How do we sort this out?
Zofia pauses thoughtfully, but then she slowly shakes her head.
Well, the birth records were clear. There was only one Thomas Schlosky born in this parish in that period, at least that I could see. As far as I'm concerned, the only thing we can clarify is Leah's story.
Maybe hers is a different family with similar names.
In a tiny little town like this, what are the odds of there being two Alexei Schlaskys who married Julitas and then had children named Emilia and Thomas?
Well, I ask hesitantly, how common are those names?
Not that common, Zofia laughs.
I hesitate, glancing back at the doors. Then I straighten my posture and say, wait here, and if she throws me out bodily this time, try to catch me before I hit the cobblestone. I walk back to the counter, where Leah and the young man have their heads close together, and they are whispering furiously. They only notice me when I'm close, and I bend down low and I say, Leah, I understand you wanting to protect your grandmother. I'd probably do the same. But my grandmother doesn't have long left, and she sent me here on this wild goose chase, and she's looking for something. I just can't help but think that your Emilia might be able to shed some light on all of this. And who knows, perhaps this confusion is part of the puzzle. So will you at least think about talking to her? Just tell her Alina Dziak or Hannah Wisniewski is trying to get in touch with her. That's all I ask. And Leah is glaring at me, but I reach across the desk, help myself to a pen and a sticky note, then scribble down my name and cell phone number. I'm here for another few days, I say. Call me anytime. Leah hesitates, but when I hold her gaze, she eventually nods. I breathe my thanks, then quickly spin on my heel and leave before she can change her mind. I find Zofia leaning against the wall of the clinic.
She surveys me warily, then laughs. What on earth did you say to her? I felt like she slammed the door in our face, I admit. So I stuck my shoe in it and made sure if she changes her mind, she has a way to contact me. That's all I can do, right? Later that night, after dinner and a glass of wine at the hotel restaurant downstairs, I pick up the phone and call Mom. She's driving to the hospital when I call, and her greeting seems unusually subdued. Hello, Alice. Hi, Mom. How was your day? Fine, she says, but she sounds distant. Is everything okay with Babsia? Oh, it's fine. I'm just tired. A little confused by this whole secret identity thing with her. I don't understand why she wouldn't tell me if she changed her name, Mom sighs. I know, I murmur. I'm sorry, Mom. I don't know what to say. I'm just hoping she recovers enough to explain herself. I was thinking that your friend there or a translator could ask her about it, but I can't see the point, because how can she tell us what happened if she can't speak? There's a million reasons she might have changed her name, so we're never going to guess, and the AAC doesn't exactly have a button for this. Mom trails off, then she clears her throat and asks, How's the rest of the expedition through Poland going? Good. We found out that Emilia Schlosky is still alive. We found her granddaughter today, and her name is Leah, which is surely just a shortening of her grandmother's name. So, will you get to speak to this Emilia? Maybe she can tell us what happened with Babcia. Something weird happened, actually. Leah was adamant that Emilia's brother Thomas died in 1942, but, well, obviously he didn't. So, some mix-up then? Yes, definitely, I say. Zofia seemed to think Emilia was assuming I was after her inheritance or something and trying to protect her family, but I pause, then admit reluctantly, my gut says that's not it, to be honest. Well, sometimes you have to trust your gut, Mom says quietly. And Alice, given you're in Poland, despite my subtle disapproval, I snort, and I hear a smile in her voice when she continues. I do suspect you already know this, but I'm going to remind you anyway. You must always remember that sometimes knocking on doors just isn't enough. What else is there in a case like this? Sometimes, if you want something badly enough, you have to smash the damn door down. If I was going to make a Julita Slosky Davis motivational poster, that's exactly what the tagline would be. I smile to myself. Mom laughs. Damn straight, daughter. I'm at the hospital, so I'm going to go now. We'll talk tomorrow. Thanks, Mom. Even after Mom and I say our goodbyes, I'm thinking about her advice. At home, I automatically apply my mom's level of determination to accessing help and support for Eddie. But when it comes to connecting with the man I share a bed with, it's a whole other story. Why haven't I forced the tension with Wade to a head in the last few years? I was definitely raised to address things straight on, so I'm not quite sure how I managed to find myself in a situation where so many things remain unspoken in my own home. I run a bath, buying some time to think before I place a call back to Wade. When I'm there at home in the day-to-day grind, I never have the space and time to try to be an impartial observer of the dynamics of our family. But now, I start to reflect on the patterns we've fallen into. I think about the resentment I feel toward Wade. That awful feeling that's muddled up with guilt and confusion because I'm in this role where I'm somehow the domestic kingpin of our family, but not at all the equal financial provider I always assumed I'd be. Somehow both a reluctant dependent and the family chief operations officer. I think about the way I've let that tension fester for so long. I'm not at all a timid woman, so why haven't I been more assertive at home? Why haven't I forced the issue of Wade's disconnect with Eddie? Why haven't I demanded an equal partner in the parenting that needs to be done? I'm terrified of what I might lose if I do. Maybe I cling too tightly to the things I can control, the routine I put in place for Eddie, the tasks around the house I like to be done just so, because deeper and broader and wider than all of that run the things in my life I can't control. I run myself ragged trying to control the world that exists around him, because I can't change him at all. I can't fix Eddie, because Eddie is not broken. He is simply different, and he is going to be like this forever because this is who he is.
This is what my life is always going to look like. Probably into old age, because Callie will grow up and leave home. But Eddie will never live independently. I haven't grieved the life I thought I'd live, and I sure as hell haven't grieved the son I thought I'd get. I got right on with accepting the son I did get, which is exactly the opposing coping mechanism to the one my husband has applied to the situation. I sink a little deeper into the bath, tears filling my eyes as I'm struck by a wave of longing so intense that it's all I can do to stay where I am. I want to run to the airport and fly home right now and take Wade and the kids into my arms and hold them all so close that they can never slip away. Even Wade. Maybe especially Wade. He and I actually need each other to achieve some kind of balance. I can't wait to hear Wade's voice and to resolve the lingering tension before I go to bed. It's 10 p.m. in Krakow now. That means 4 p.m. back home. And because it's Wednesday, he and Eddie should be in the viewing room at ballet, watching Callie's class. I slip quickly out of the bath, pull on the hotel robe, and call. But when the call connects, it's immediately obvious to me that they are not in the viewing room at ballet. Wade? I call, surprised.
Eddie, I love you!
Eddie echoes, surprise and delight in his tone. The phone shifts a little, and his face fills the screen. He stares into the phone, bringing it too close. Eddie looks blissfully happy. His big green eyes are positively brimming with joy. Eddie looks as if he's just been given some kind of deliriously magical gift. Eddie looks as if my call is icing on an already pretty exceptional cake. As I digest all this, I suddenly recognize the brick wall behind him. Hello, baby, I say softly. Daddy has taken you to the train station, huh?
Hello, Alice, Wade says from off-screen. Yes, we figured there was not much point watching Pascal at ballet, so we went for a walk. Once we got onto the block near the station, Eddie went on autopilot and all but dragged me in here. So I'm guessing you do this too sometimes.
I would never take Eddie for a spontaneous walk like that. I'd never risk it. What if we ran into a situation where he had a meltdown? What if he ran off? I plan my outings with Eddie like teachers plan their excursions. I schedule things. I put them onto his visual timetable. I consider the risks. I make contingency plans. But that also means I don't ever get to see that same surprised joy on Eddie's face that Wade has managed to achieve right now. There are no surprises in Eddie's life with me. I'm utterly bewildered by the jealousy I feel. We go there on Friday morning if he stays at school all day on Thursday, and we park at the same place for ballet. So I guess he knows the way, I say, my voice trailing off. I fall silent then, watching as Eddie's gaze leaves the phone screen to focus on something in front of him. I suspect from the ever-growing excitement in his eyes that he's looking at an approaching train. What's the plan tonight? I ask Wade.
Soup is the plan tonight, he says.
He's still off screen, but there's no mistaking the edge of bitterness in his tone.
Is that why you called? To check?
I called because I had a really emotional and confusing day, and I just wanted to hear your voice, I say. It's astounding how I genuinely wanted to connect with him on this call, but less than 60 seconds into it, he makes a comment like that, and in an instant, I feel defensive, and the bitterness that leaps into my tone instantly matches the level in his. No wonder we're in such a mess. I feel like we're on either side of a very long footbridge, and we're both afraid to set out onto it. Each time one of us steps forward, the other steps back in case the bridge can't take our weight. I can't fight with him tonight. I just don't have the emotional reserves. I take a deep breath and say evenly, but now isn't really the time for that chat, I guess. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Eddie's face disappears from the screen, and in his place I see Wade. There are heavy bags beneath his eyes, and for the first time in living memory, he hasn't shaved on a workday.
Don't hang up, Allie, he murmurs. I have to say something. And brace yourself, this is going to be shocking.
I can tell he's about to make a joke, and I laugh a little in anticipation. I'm braced, I joke in return. Go ahead.
Two kids, significantly more difficult to manage than 300 lab rats. This is no holiday, and I'm really sorry about before. And I'm sorry about the soup, he sighs heavily, then says wryly, let it be known that I'm sorry about pretty much everything at this point.
I'm sorry too, I whisper, and then I touch the screen with my forefinger, feeling again that soul-deep pang of longing. I stare right into his eyes on the screen, and my voice is rough with emotion as I choke. I really miss you, Wade.
I miss you too.
I hear the rumbling of the coming train, and then I see the rush of wind mess with Wade's hair. I want to ask him about the new Go-Gurt labels and to see Eddie again, to see that Eddie really is okay. But this clearly isn't the time to talk, because Wade has to shout into the phone as the train draws near.
Let's talk properly tomorrow, when I'm not at a train station.
I laugh and nod, then kiss my finger and press it to the camera. I love you, I whisper. He reads my lips, and I see him echo it back to me.
Chapter 33. Alina. As we walked back to my family home, Saul tried hard to convince us to leave him behind, but he was too exhausted to make a convincing argument. He eventually gave up on Tomas, and when he instead tried to convince me, I found myself in the god-awful position of taking Tomas's side. It makes sense for you to join me on the journey, I forced myself to say. Tomas is needed here. It would take at least 6 hours for the plaster cast to dry, and Tomas wanted it close to set before we boarded the truck. The original plan would have had us back to my family home with plenty of time for the cast to cure, but now we arrived back at the farmhouse just as the clock struck 3 a.m. I'd be boarding the truck with the cast still wet and truly soft.
You will have to be so careful, Tomas whispered, shaking his head as he wound the bandage onto my forearm.
I had been staring up at the floorboards of my childhood home, trying to convince myself that this really was going to be my very last time there, unable to bear to watch as he wound the plaster around the canister onto my wrist.
Be absolutely sure to not bump it until it dries. It simply has to look realistic, or someone might become suspicious that there's something valuable in there. And do not let this cast get wet. Even once it's cured, the film must stay dry. Farther toward the wrist, Tomas, Saul said. His voice was suddenly strong, as if he hadn't just lost his whole world a few hours earlier. Tomas adjusted the placement of the soft bandage that would line the cast, shifting it a little farther from my elbow.
Better?
Yes.
You are very short on supplies. Better to do a short cast and make it thick to hide the bulk of the canister. Remember, you're not actually needing to stabilize the movement of her arm in this case. However, if this were a real fracture, well, this would be inadequate. However, in our circumstances, if anyone even knows to question the length of it, Alina can say the fracture was right above the wrist, and her physician did the best he could with what he had.
I looked down at Saul. He was sitting on the floor against one of the walls of the cellar. His arms were around his legs, his knees drawn up to his body, and he stared up at us on the makeshift bed with flat eyes and a deathly pale face. He met my gaze, and his tone softened a little as he suggested,
"If someone asks how you got the injury, say you fell and had stretched your hand out before you. The wrist